Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, January 7th, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call as we preview the Friedrichs case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two return guests to Teleforum. We'll hear first opening remarks from each. We'll hear first from William Messenger, Bill Messenger. He's a staff attorney at National Right to Work and Legal Defense Foundation, Incorporated, right here in the Washington, D.C. area, and he'll be followed in opening remarks by Carrie Severino. She's Chief Counsel and Policy Director at the Judicial Crisis Network, also here in D.C. After those opening remarks, we're going to be turning to you for questions, so please be thinking of those questions when we get to that portion of the program. Also, just a quick note that on January 11th, when this case is argued, we'll hear again from Bill Messenger a report on what transpires in the oral argument, but for today, of course, in anticipation of that argument, a preview of what might happen. With that, Mr. Messenger, the floor is yours.
Thank you. And so the question presented in Friedrichs, the primary question, is it constitutional under the First Amendment for the government to force public employees to pay union dues as a condition of their employment? And sort of the sub-question that really hinges on is whether the court should overrule a case called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. And what I'd like to do is just briefly sketch out the history of the litigation in this area, Abood and compulsory fees. And once we get up to Friedrichs, to turn it over to Carrie to explain exactly the structure of that case and the various arguments being made. But what I'd like to do first is just to lay the background for our discussion, because otherwise the discussion of Friedrichs won't make a lot of sense. And where I'd like to pick up the story is in Abood versus Detroit Board of Education itself. There were some earlier compulsory fee cases under the Railway Labor Act, but for simplicity, start with Abood. And in Abood, the question was the same as in Friedrichs. Was it constitutional to force public school teachers to pay union dues as a condition of keeping their job at the public school? And unfortunately, the United States Supreme Court, this is 1977, held that it was. And what the Abood court did was create a dichotomy. And what the court said was expenses for collective bargaining and things related to collective bargaining were chargeable to teachers. In other words, teachers could be forced to pay for union costs of collective bargaining and things related to it. However, on the other hand, non-union teachers could not be forced to pay for political and ideological expenses. So what Abood really did is make this distinction between collective bargaining expenses on one hand and political expenses on the other. Now, there was a dissent. It was technically a concurrence, but it was really a dissent by Justice Powell. And what Justice Powell said is, this distinction doesn't make sense, because when you're dealing with the government, there is no difference between collectively bargaining with government and lobbying the government. In either case, you have an interest group trying to influence the way a government program is run. They're the public schools, so in fact, this distinction does not exist. But Justice Powell was in the minority, and so Abood became the law of the land. Now, between 1977 up until recently, there was a large number of cases dealing with exactly how to apply Abood, try to make the line of what is chargeable and not chargeable under Abood, what kind of notice has to be given. But sort of the story starts to change in a case called Knox versus SEIU. In Knox versus SEIU, an SEIU local in California forced non-union teachers to pay money to what it called a political fight-back fund to fund its opposition, the union's opposition to a ballot initiative campaign. And the union did so without giving these individuals the opportunity to opt out of paying for those expenses. And in Knox, the Supreme Court suddenly started to clarify, I'd say, the law on this issue. And it did two very important things. The first is that the court made clear for the first time that compulsory union fees were subject to what's called exacting constitutional scrutiny, which is a very high level of scrutiny. That requires that the compelled fee be justified by a compelling government interest and be the least restrictive means for meeting that interest. Prior to Knox, the court was always rather unclear of exactly what standard of scrutiny was using. And in fact, in Abood, it appears, although the case is somewhat unclear, that the court certainly didn't use exacting scrutiny, but may have even used a far lower standard than that. So Knox makes clear for the first time that, like any other compulsory association, exacting scrutiny applies. And Knox also criticized what's called union objection requirements. Most unions, when they force employees to pay compulsory fees to them, require that the employee affirmatively object in order to stop paying fees, even for politics. So in other words, the union will take fees from you, including for politics, unless you raise an affirmative objection for paying for those politics. Knox strongly suggested, if not held, that requiring such objections is illegal, and instead the union needs consent on the front end. So that was Knox. And then the very next year, the court granted a case called Harris versus Quinn. In Harris versus Quinn, the issue there was whether you could extend a BOOD and compulsory union fees beyond full-fledged public employees to independent providers who worked in their homes. So, for example, in Harris v. Quinn, Pam Harris was an individual who took care of her own disabled son in her own home and received Medicaid payments for so doing. And the state of Illinois tried to force her to pay compulsory union fees as a condition of receiving the Medicaid payment for the services to her son. So the question is, can you expand a BOOD beyond the employment situation? And what the Supreme Court held is, no, you couldn't, that a BOOD didn't extend that far. However, in so doing, the Supreme Court, for the first time, directly criticized a BOOD. In fact, very strongly criticized a BOOD. Five members of the court basically said that they thought a BOOD was wrongly decided. And the main grounds for which is that there is no difference between collective bargaining and lobbying in the public sector, that they are, in fact, one and the same. And that even to the extent there is a difference, it's very hard to make that distinction as a practical matter. They raised other arguments. That was the primary one. However, the court didn't overrule Abood or said it didn't need to reach that question because it didn't need to reach that question to decide the case. By holding that Abood didn't apply to these non-employee providers, the court didn't need to decide if Abood was right or not. It reserved that question for another day, and that day is today, in taking the Friedrichs case. And so to discuss exactly what the Friedrichs case is about and sort of the arguments and its background, I'd like to turn it over to Carrie.
Thanks for that historical context of where we are. So today's or this week's upcoming case is Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. And this one in many ways presents the same questions but doesn't allow the easy kind of escape door exit that the Harris case did because however the court decides it, it's going to be squarely presented with the question of are we actually following Abood in this case? Or are we going to overrule it? And that's been explicit from as the case has been taken up. I think everyone agrees that the whole case turns on, is Abood going to really be overruled? California's teacher union laws provide that the schools that vote to have union representation, that union is the exclusive representative of the teachers, and they have a duty of fair representation, so they can't, for example, say non-union members are going to get lower wages than union members or worse conditions somehow. They have to kind of bargain for the same conditions for everyone, union or non-union members. But non-members of the union are required, as held under Abood, to pay what they call the chargeable fees. So they, first of all, they're defaulted into a system where they would automatically pay this full agency fee, which is generally equivalent to the same amount that members would pay for their union dues in the first place. But they are given an opportunity to opt out of paying the non-chargeable portion, so the portion directly related to lobbying and political activity by the union. They receive a notice that's a form that outlines which parts of the agency fees go to the political non-chargeable things and which are chargeable, and then they have a narrow window in which they can opt out. So they have to return this form. They have to return it with a specific procedure. It has to be mailed in. It can't be faxed, et cetera. And it has to be within this certain window. Otherwise, they're going to be charged the full fee. And to give you a sense of what that is, generally the annual dues are about $1,000 per teacher, and that would be the amount that would be paid by even a non-member if they don't hit check the opt-out thing and get that all of those forms filled in and returned properly. And if they do opt out, they'll get about $350 to $400 refund annually. So it's a significant amount of money, and it's a significant portion of the fees they're otherwise going to be charged. So the case presents two questions. The first is the most direct, and I think is likely the one the court will decide, and that is straight up, should Abood be overruled? And if so, then you would have non-union members not being forced to pay for this union that they have chosen not to join, that they disagree with. And we're talking about plaintiffs here who all of whom have chosen to opt out of the union but still have been forced to pay many of these dues. The second question is whether it violates the First Amendment to have an opt-out process rather than for people who don't want to pay those the non-chargeable political fees, or whether the First Amendment at a minimum at least requires that you, as it suggested in Knox, that you don't charge them and then ask them to opt out, that you have to ask them, they have to agree to opt in to the political charges. So on the first question, I think the biggest issues are looking at the justification for allowing government union shops and with mandatory agency fees and seeing if they really apply here. So the court in Abood talked about union peace and talked about free riding. But the petitioners in this case argue that that diminishing this revenue by the I think it's 9% or so of employees who are non-union members isn't actually going to destroy union peace. It's certainly not going to destroy the unions. We have 20-something states that do have right-to-work laws where state employees can't be forced to join a union, and we still see robust unions in those states. We haven't seen that they've spiraled off into having no employees. The bottom line is there are a lot of employees who feel they are well represented by the union, and maybe want to continue that, and they have the freedom to do so. This simply is saying that the 9 or 10% who, in the case of the California teachers unions, who don't want to, will be able to step back and say I'm not going to be forced to participate in this process. The free riding principle, I think, is also one that people will say this is called they're calling it a fair share payment, saying that you're receiving a benefit from the union, and so you should pay for it. And the benefit is allegedly that you're getting higher payment, you're getting better work conditions because the union is arguing for you. I think one of the fundamental arguments there is what really qualifies as a benefit. The petitioners in this case actually think many of the things the union says are a benefit are contrary to what they believe. So even things like tenure requirements, the union may say, well, this is a benefit because you gain tenure and now you have more guaranteed employment. But petitioners actually think that they would do better on a merit system. They think that they would they're better than average. They would rise more quickly and actually succeed better in a merit-based system rather than in a tenure-based system. They also may be concerned with the problems with state budgets, saying, hey, you know what, I actually don't, even though it might mean more take-home pay for me on a certain level, I think it makes more sense to be balancing the state budget in a different way. All of these are inherently political questions that you could have a wide range of views on, not simply the union's view of we're going to try to maximize what we think the teachers' best cost should be. There's also on the free riding issue, there's the argument that regardless of whether these 9 or 10% of non-union members are required to pay, the union is going to be arguing for exactly the same thing. So their arguments are not going to change whether these non-members are part of the union or not. They're not representing their interests particularly, obviously, because the non-members are annoyed that they disagree with the union. So they're going to basically behave the same way. And the reason that people are being accused of free riding is actually the fault of the way the state law is set up that prohibits them from independently making their own arguments. They actually don't view themselves as free riding. They don't want what the union is offering. The union has asserted that they should be required to pay these things because they're getting this fair representation, and they're also offering a grievance process to the employees. As I mentioned, the fair representation, I think, doesn't necessarily get there because the unions, the only thing that says is the unions can't bargain for lower benefits for non-members. It doesn't really change what they're bargaining for. Either way, they're going forward with what they think their members want, And they're not taking the non-members' interests into account. So they're just basically bargaining for the same thing, and the question is simply whether whether the non-members get it or not. Either way, it doesn't. The fair representation thing doesn't change the union's view. There's also the grievance process. There's certainly mechanisms the state could require if a non-member were using the grievance process that they perhaps could subsidize or cover the cost of that process each time. There are other situations in which that happens. So those are some of the arguments that the unions have made. On the second question regarding the opt-out, I think many people see this as something like the Harris, a potential out for the court. If they don't have the stomach for overturning Abood, then perhaps they'll go to this opt-out question. I think there the arguments are very parallel to those brought in Knox, and I think that seems like it should be a pretty easy hurdle to overcome. If you look at the compelling government interests here, it's hard to see that requiring people to opt out rather than opt in is going to be a problem. Imagine one of the parallels given in the briefs is imagine everyone in the state was required, or all the teachers were required to give a 1% of their wages to the Democratic Party unless they opted out. We would see that as a huge violation of their First Amendment rights to simply take money that you're not entitled to force them to subsidize speech they don't like. And it's no excuse to say, well, no problem, I've allowed them an opt-out process. That's simply not the way the First Amendment generally works. On top of which, what we're talking about here are non-members of the union. So if there's any presumption that we ought to have, it's that these are people who disagree with how the union is speaking in a political way, not that these are people who agree. So it's hard to imagine why we would have a system that presumes they're going to want to subsidize union political speech rather than presuming the other way and then allowing them to opt in if they choose to. So that's it. That's sort of a summary of where this case is, what some of the arguments are in this case, and happy to take questions or if Bill has any other comments on it.
Well, thank you both. This is Dean Reuter again. Let me open the floor to questions before I go back to Bill Messenger and see if he wants to supplement his statement at all. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, just push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I've got a couple questions, but before we go to questions, let me see if Bill Messenger wants to supplement his opening remarks.
No, I think that Kerry certainly covered the waterfront as far as the arguments being raised in Friedrichs, and while I can certainly elaborate on some of the arguments and counterarguments, I think I'm interested to hear what the callers, what their questions are, and if not, then we could address some of our own.
Okay. Before we go to questions, just a quick announcement about our next scheduled teleform conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be talking about class action litigation and when the numbers get to points that might become implausible in terms of the ratio between class settlement that goes to the class versus the plaintiff's attorneys. With that, again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've just got one audience member question pending, so let's go to that first question.
Hi, this is Aaron from Alexandria. I would like to ask Mr. Messenger if he thinks that the decision in Friedrichs will have any effect on employees covered by the National Labor Relations Act or the Railway Labor Act.
It may. It depends on exactly how the Supreme Court addresses the question. But what the Supreme Court says certainly could apply, because you have cases decided under the Railway Labor Act that are informed by the First Amendment. Under the Railway Labor Act, which is a private labor statute, the court construed that statute to avoid constitutional difficulties and basically brought the same regime as Abood into the RLA, although it actually happened beforehand, that you can charge employees for collective bargaining, but you can't charge them for political expenses. And then the case law under the Railway Labor Act was then brought under the National Labor Relations Act under Beck, where they decided to construe the compulsory fee provisions of the National Labor Relations Act the same way. And so logically, if the constitutional dimension changes in Friedrichs of what the Constitution demands, then that should also press the private sector labor statutes in the same direction. Because if those statutes have to be construed to avoid constitutional difficulties, and now if charging any fees causes constitutional difficulties, then those statutes should be interpreted to outlaw compulsory fees, or rather the statute should be overturned. However, there are additional hurdles in the private sector that aren't there in the public sector. So it's not quite as simple as that. But hopefully a decision in Friedrichs, a favorable decision, if there is one, can eventually be brought under the public from the public sector to the private sector.
Once again, our lines are wide open now. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me give you, while we're waiting, Mr. Messenger or Carrie Severino, a chance to talk about some of those additional hurdles, the distinction between some of the private union issues and the public union issues that are here presented in the Friedrichs case.
Well, sure, I'll take that. And so two of the arguments we have, the National Right to Work Foundation attorneys represent individual private sector employees who are challenging compulsory fees under the Railway Labor Act in a case called CERNA, which is currently pending at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. There was an argument held, but the case has now been held pending Friedrichs, and so there'll be a decision in that soon, that basically argues that compulsory fees and objection requirements in the private sector under the Railway Labor Act should also be struck down as unconstitutional. And the basic argument for that was the one I just gave. I don't think it should be a hurdle, but just to say what the unions are arguing in that case, the one is that in the public sector, obviously collective bargaining and lobbying are one and the same. I should say obviously, but it seems rather apparent to me that's the position and what the court implicated or said in Harris, that they're one and the same. That's not true in the private sector. There is a distinction between a private employer and the government. Now, we submit that distinction shouldn't matter because speech is speech. And while political speech may be higher on the First Amendment totem pole, the reality is that speech within a private employer is also protected by the First Amendment and shouldn't necessarily make a distinction. Another argument that the unions are making is state action, that there shouldn't be a finding of state action under the Railway Labor Act. However, that's contrary to a decision by the Supreme Court in Hansen. So at least under prior precedent right now, there is state action on the Railway Labor Act, but the unions continue to argue that there is a lack of state action, and so there's no constitutional implications at all. So those are the two main union arguments. On the objection requirement, it's basically the same thing as in Friedrichs. Should you presume that non-members don't want to pay dues to the union, or should you presume that they do? And obviously, I think the first presumption makes a lot more sense.
We've got a couple questions pending now. Let's take another question from our audience, if we could.
Hi, my name is Steve McCloskey, and this is for Carrie. First of all, greetings from Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
How you doing?
And Carrie, I was wondering, you were talking about the fees that had been, I know very little about union law, so I hope this isn't too naive, the fees that were deducted for the negotiation part of the union dues. I'm curious, how often would somebody like the California Teachers Association renegotiate it? Is it every 2 years? Is it every 4 years? And does the fee that is taken out of the non-union member's salary, does that come out every year or only in a year when there is negotiation? Thank you.
So my understanding, and Bill, correct me if you know more details about the facts here, is that the union dues are an annual thing, and I don't think it's keyed to I think maybe keyed to the previous year's actual expenditures, but I don't think it's keyed to are we planning on renegotiating this year or not. But I think an important point is that, like with some of the other points, regardless of whether the non-union members are there or even exist or not, the union is going to have the same – there's really no difference in what the union is doing in terms of renegotiating because they're simply negotiating on behalf of their members, and then whatever they get for their members is automatically applied to the non-members. So it's not as if in the negotiation process that I, in any way I could think of, it's not as if it costs the union more money to negotiate for 1,000 employees versus 900 employees. But I also don't believe that the union fees are necessarily I don't think they go up and down in anticipation of union negotiations in that year.
And typically, how long do those contracts last? Are they renegotiated every 2 years, 3 years, 4 years?
That I do not know. I don't know if Bill knows more on the details of.
I don't know California practice specifically. I mean, in general, under private sector labor law, 3 years is sort of the standard. Sometimes they're a little longer. Some years are shorter. You can do whatever you want, really. But 3 years is sort of the standard because that's where the decertification bar is. In other words, they don't allow you to decertify the union for at least the first 3 years. I don't know if California follows that private practice, but my guess is it probably does. So figure most are probably about three. Some can be longer.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And then to turn to the fee issue, what Carrie said is correct. It doesn't change because what unions do is they don't charge for the actual cost of negotiating your contract. So let's say you're covered by a particular union local. You're not just paying for negotiating your contract through that local. You pay for all union activities that are related to collective bargaining, even if it's about collective bargaining clear on the other side of the country, as far as a compulsory fee. So it doesn't – you're not just paying for bargaining for you. And it's under what the Supreme Court's pooling decisions that sort of all the union can pool its expenses for collective bargaining and for anything else, even if it's not directly on behalf of your bargaining unit. Really what they're paying for is collective bargaining in general, not necessarily collective bargaining on their behalf.
Appreciate it.
What's the logic behind that pooling? Is that just sort of a bookkeeping shortcut or –
The logic of it, I disagree with, but I'll say what it is. The rationale is that it's similar to an insurance company in that the rest of the union structure will support this particular local in negotiations. So let's say you're under Union Local 1, it's negotiating a contract. The rest of the union resources can support that local. And then next year, it might be a different local up, but it's still the same organization funding it, and so it sort of moves around. Now, the problem with that is that the bookkeeping on that doesn't exactly make a whole lot of sense because bargaining on the other side of the country, there isn't necessarily how much money you spend for any given local may not necessarily reflect the total amount that the union spends on collective bargaining.
Right.
I don't know if that makes sense, but there's a bit of a mismatch there because what unions will do in their compulsory fees is just say, any expense we have that's related to collective bargaining, we're going to force you to pay for. But that does, just because it's related to collective bargaining doesn't necessarily mean it's an expense or amount of stream of income that your particular local could call upon. But the Supreme Court, at least as of so far, has adopted at least part of the pooling rationale in a case called Locke versus Carass that they can pool to a large degree.
Got it. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, and then our lines are wide open, so let's now take another call.
Doug Seaton here in Minneapolis. I wondered if Bill could comment on any possible implications of a Friedrichs decision on the cases that he's been working on, and I've got a parallel one, too, involving child care and personal care attendant unionization. These are categories which are not really public employees per the Harris decision, and I'm just wondering what he thinks implications might be.
Sure. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Bill.
The ultimate result in Harris, in Friedrichs, probably won't change the outcome of those cases, but many of the arguments raised can. And the main issue that Doug brings up, there's a whole series of cases following Harris that allege that not only is it illegal to force these non-employee providers to pay compulsory union fees, it's also unconstitutional to force them to accept exclusive union representation. Because exclusive union representation forces these providers or employees to accept the union as their mandatory agent for dealing with the government over its operation of a program. In effect, the union is a mandatory lobbyist, and you know we submit in a variety of cases that this infringes on their First Amendment rights to choose who represents them before the government. And so there's several cases like this around the country. They're currently pending. And some of the arguments in Friedrichs could go back to that because some of the union arguments they're making in Friedrichs are the same ones they're making in these cases. So just to raise one, for example, in Friedrichs, the union argues that compulsory fees aren't a problem because employees remain free to speak, notwithstanding the union. It's the same argument they're making in the exclusive representation cases. And I submit that argument doesn't make a lot of sense because the government can't force someone to associate in violation of the First Amendment rights just because the individual is otherwise free to speak. Justice Scalia actually put it pretty well during oral argument at Harris. He said, I guess the fact you're entitled to speak against abortion wouldn't justify the government forcing you to support Planned Parenthood. And I think the same rationale applies. And there's also some other arguments, sort of buried in the weeds of Friedrichs that could affect the exclusive representation cases. So it's be very interesting to see not only what the result of Friedrichs is, but exactly what the court says in reaching that result. And those could have a variety of implications, not just for the provider cases, but for all of labor law.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, so let's keep rolling here.
Hello, this is Mark Scarberry. I had to step away, and I might have missed this earlier, but how honest do you think the accounting is? I'm a member of the California State Bar, and our deduction amount was $5 out of several hundred dollars of bar dues. It struck me that that probably was not a particularly accurate description of the amount of money spent by the California Bar on non-chargeable matters. And I know it's a little different issue under Keller, but I'm wondering if you think that the amounts are fairly determined and what the difficulties are in making sure that they're fairly determined.
Well, I'll point out that that's one of the problems with the system that is on the border of this case is that the accounting given in the form where you check the box is, of course, the accounting done by the unions. And I don't know that there's a way you can check another box to challenge it, but the burden is heavily in favor of someone in favor of the union. So if you want to challenge it, it would be very, very difficult to do so. I think it's the union accounting all the way down.
Yes, and this is in Harris, of the six reasons the Harris court gave for why Abood should be overruled. Number six was that it's very difficult to tell what is properly chargeable given that it's the union that makes those determinations. And so all the auditors do when there's a compulsory fee, at least for unions and probably for the state bar, is they determine if the union's numbers add up. But what really matters is how does the union classify things as chargeable and non-chargeable. So, for example, if a union official entering his time says, 70% of what I did was collective bargaining and 30% political, the auditor doesn't actually look to see if he fairly described political versus collective bargaining. It just sees that the numbers add up. So the unions have a huge amount of control over exactly how they can structure their compulsory fees. And as Carrie mentioned, it's extremely difficult to challenge. Technically, you can. You could also challenge it in federal court. But the amount of time and work in those cases is astronomical because basically you're going through audits of extremely large organizations, and the determinations that go from chargeable to non-chargeable are very subtle. The National Right to Work Foundation has supported employees in two or three of those kind of cases, and they're very difficult. And so the entire system isn't set up in a way that really protects, employee rights not to be forced to pay compulsory fees just because of the way the accounting works.
And no fee recovery, I assume, if you're successful.
Well, there would be. So if you file a lawsuit alleging that the union's books didn't add up and the judge agreed with you, you would receive a recovery, of the non-chargeable amount. Now, you wouldn't get it all back, just whatever that non-chargeable is.
I mean the fees involved in challenging it, the attorney's fees and the other costs.
Yes, that's true under a contractual challenge that Carrie mentioned, checking the challenge box. However, the attorney's fees, it depends. If you bring it under Civil Rights Statute 1983, that is a fee-shifting statute. So an attorney's fees recovery isn't impossible. But I certainly wouldn't recommend it to any plaintiff's lawyer sitting out there looking to make money because it's a lot more work than it is recovery.
And you're fighting some very deep pockets.
Yes. Yes, and the other problem there is that there's no incentive for the employee because even if the union's accounting is off by 10%, for any given employee, how much money really is that? So let's say the CTA, the California Teacher Association, did its books in a way that overcharged employees by 10%. And let's say CTA dues are about $1,000 a year, which they are. That's only $100. Is it worth being involved in a huge litigation campaign over $100 for yourself? Now, for the union, if you represent, you know, 20,000 employees, that's real money. And so the incentives at work, the unions have far more financial incentive to push the envelope on charging and everything else than any individual employee has to push back, other than the fact that many of these employees, particularly our clients and Ms. Friedrichs too, you know, do it on principle, because it's the principle of the matter more than the money. But the underlying financial incentives very much favor the unions.
And I don't suppose class action works here. And the other question, I suppose, would be whether there may be arbitration requirements in some of the contracts. But I'll leave it there. Thanks for your patience.
They can't just quickly follow up on those. They can't require arbitration. You can go to arbitration. The union has to give you that option. But they can't force you to go to arbitration as opposed to going under 1983. They can be done as class actions. We have had class certified under those theories. But again, that's in and of itself a high mountain to climb.
Thank you.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see. Oh, we do have another question. I will shelf my own question and take this next one from the audience.
Hi, my question is for either one of the panelists, and it deals with the free rider problem in the context of grievance processing. You know, the unions argue that when it comes to grievances, if a non-member files a grievance, they really do have additional expenses, that maybe some non-member got fired and now they have to take his case to arbitration, and that's really expensive. And so they argue that there's more of a free rider problem in the grievance area than in other areas. And I'm wondering how you respond to that and whether you think that's a good argument for them.
Well, I would say there's maybe more of a free rider problem there, but it's still not a significant one for a couple reasons. One is even assuming so first of all, I think it's likely that the union might want to take these grievance cases anyway, simply because the same problems that are happening would affect their members. So in order to create precedent, make sure that their members are also getting treated properly, they're going to want to follow up if there's a pattern of behavior that's problematic on the employer side. But second of all, there's already a process that's in existence that would allow for them to simply charge those costs, and that's a kind of different wrinkle in the case, which is that for people who have religious objections, there's actually another system in place where instead of giving they still have to pay the agency fees, but instead of giving them to the union, they give them to one of three union-approved charities. Now, there's all sorts of issues with that in the first place, of whether they should be forced to give their money to charities they might not even approve of. But setting those aside, in those situations, if they have a grievance, then they pay the cost of the grievance. And I think if you wanted to address, even if you assumed, yes, this is going to be an additional cost placed on the unions, it would be very easy to address it in that way and say, okay, if you have a grievance then and the union does it, you simply have to pay that amount, or maybe allow people to just bring their own counsel or something like that if they're non-union members.
Yeah, and I think that the big thing, and that grievances aren't different from collective bargaining and from anything else. I mean, they're equally political. All a grievance is enforcing a collective bargaining agreement. So if the act of negotiating a collective bargaining agreement with a government is a political act, which it is because it's basically dictating government policy, then the act of enforcing that agreement is equally political. They're two sides of the same coin. There's no distinction. So compulsory fees for grievances should be no different than compulsory fees for collective bargaining. And I think one of the big things that's important with grievances is the union controls the grievance process. So sort of the hypothetical, there's a misconception out there that individual employees could bring their own grievances if they want to, but they're just enlisting the union for its help that the union is forced to give. That's not actually what happens. What the union says is you can only process a grievance beyond step two or step three with the union. And in fact, this is in California law. California law says only the union can take a grievance to arbitration. So if you're an individual employee, you have no choice but to go through the union. And also unions usually require to go to what's called step two, which is usually mediation or a formal meeting, that only the union can do that. Not always, but that's a common contractual provision. So this isn't the situation of a non-union employee just asking for help because it's free. He has to go through the union. He has no choice. And I think that changes the analysis a lot in two ways. First, this control over the grievance process is a huge benefit and power for the union. It's not a liability or an expense, because by having control over the grievance process, that gives the union a lot of leverage to make employees want to join the union, because you know full well that the union is very likely not going to help you out in your grievance unless you're a dues-paying member. If the union boss or union steward doesn't like you, the odds are he's just going to let your grievance die, and because he has a great discretion to do so under the duty of fair representation. So the concept that grievance adjustment is somehow a burden on the union, I don't think is true. And then second, it also goes to the fairness point. It's not unfair to allow employees not to be forced to pay for union grievance representation because the employee doesn't have a choice. He has to go through the union. And if someone doesn't have a choice whether or not to use the service, there should be no obligation to pay for that service. And so for those reasons, you know, I disagree a little bit on the legality of a fee just for grievance processing, primarily because it's not a free choice for the employee. They're forced to use the union. And because they're forced to use the union to move their grievance forward, they shouldn't be forced to pay for something maybe they never wanted in the first place.
Great. Thank you.
We do have another question among our audience members, so let's take that next call.
This is John from Fairfax. I think Carrie made a mistake when she referred to unions being able to charge religious objectors for grievances. It's pretty clear that in all the cases that have occurred, unions have not been able to charge religious objectors for grievances. They have a duty of fair representation because of this exclusivity that they impose on religious objectors to represent them.
Well, I can go back and double-check that. My understanding was that was how it was dealt with in this case, but I'll certainly, if you know more of the details and the facts of this case, I'm happy to concede that one.
Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about almost 20 minutes left while we're waiting to see if there's other questions from the audience. Let me ask you, Bill Messenger, a question about Harris v. Quinn, which is the most recent case in the line of cases you mentioned. Originally, you mentioned that five justices were critical of Abood. Later, I think I heard you say that they gave as many as six reasons for overturning Abood, or six reasons that Abood ought to be overturned. I just wanted to clarify with you and see if, I mean, did they speak that strongly about overturning Abood? Were they that definitive? Who were the five justices? And were there any concurrences or any hedging in the language by any of the five justices?
So the five justices to which I'm speaking of are Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Alito. Justice Alito wrote the opinions or the opinion for the court in Harris. So the five I'm talking about refer to those justices.
Mm-hmm.
And in Harris, the court was pretty strong on its criticisms of why it didn't think Abood made sense. I went through the history of Abood, sort of rejected some of the union arguments about how the case law actually progressed up to Abood, made clear that, in fact, the Railway Labor Act cases that Abood relied upon did not directly address the constitutional question presented in Abood. So they sort of expressly rejected sort of Abood's reliance on prior case law. And after that point, they gave six reasons why they thought Abood, you know, didn't make sense. But then at that point afterwards, you know, they said, we don't need to reach that question here today, and then moved on to distinguish the independent providers in Harris from the Abood employees. So basically, they didn't need to reach the question of
right.
whether to overrule Abood, you know, to decide the case.
Right. Well, it sounds like they spoke pretty definitively. Let me ask you, is there any way they could distinguish the current case? And even if there's no way that you can see. Is there another follow-on case? Is there a next Friedrichs case just in the event that the court doesn't take this opportunity to overrule Abood?
Yeah, I don't think there's any way for them to distinguish Abood here. You have teachers being forced to pay compulsory fees. The petitioners structured their case, so it was completely dependent upon whether Abood lived or died. They didn't raise any claim that was viable if Abood survived. Well, I take that back. The objection requirement is, at least for the Supreme Court, is an open question, if not one that favors the petitioners under Knox. I was referring just to the first question on compulsory fees.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's extremely likely that the court will tackle Abood head on here. It's always possible, of course, they could issue some decision in the middle saying, well, we're going to set out these new principles and then send it back for more development or something to that effect. That's not impossible. But I think that it'll probably be either Abood survives or it doesn't at the end of the day here.
We do have an audience question pending now. I'll go to that in a minute. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask you just one quick question on the opt-in, opt-out. It feels to me like we're living in an opt-in world nowadays, although maybe at one time it was an opt-out world. Was anybody in this case citing the tax checkoff that the U.S. government gives you the opportunity to opt in to giving $3 or whatever it is to the presidential public funding program? Did that become an issue in this case? Who else is requiring opt-in versus opt-out? What the conventions are in this country?
That's a good question. On the taxpayer cases, I don't know. There were a lot of briefs filed in this case. There are two respondents, the United States, and then a large number of amicus briefs on both sides. I'd be surprised if that issue wasn't raised, if somebody didn't raise it. But I couldn't tell you off the top of my head if that particular case is there. But I can tell you the respondents have raised other constitutional cases where an affirmative request to invoke a right is required. I don't remember them off the top of my head, but things like right to remain silent, right to an attorney, things based on criminal matters where the criminal defendant has to affirmatively say they want it. And then they try to make an analogy based upon that, saying that invoking your right not to support a union should basically fall under the same analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So that argument is out there. I submit they're different situations, because in those cases, the government has the authority to do what it's doing in the first instance. It can try someone unless and until they invoke their right to counsel or something to that effect. Here, for non-chargeable fees, which means either political fees or all fees, the state has no authority to take that money in the first place. And I think Kerry's analogy earlier is a great one. The state of California couldn't just say, we're going to take 1% of everybody's money and give it to the Democratic Party unless and until you object.
Right.
And the reason is California has no right to take that money in the first place. And same thing here with the school districts and the California Teachers Association. There should be no lawful taking to which these teachers have to object, because the CTA has no right to take at least the political portion of their money, and if count one goes the right way, the right to take any of their money.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Let's turn now to that question.
This is Robert Ault calling from Columbus, Ohio. My question dealt with really sort of the core question that's before the court, the question of whether or not to overturn Abood. Union advocates seem to be turning their attention to the Chief Justice and raising the issue that stare decisis really should control, particularly given comments he made in his confirmation hearings, and that any shift away from what they cast as a venerable 40-year-old precedent would politicize the court. I wondered if actually both of you could comment a bit, a good FedSoc question about the role of stare decisis and why adhering to past precedent might not be advisable in this case.
Sure, I'll take Okay. There's a number of arguments the petitioners raised against stare decisis, but I'd just focus on two, or maybe three, that I think are top of the food chain. The first is that when it comes to First Amendment and constitutional principles, stare decisis is somewhat weaker, given that that's at the core of the Constitution. And that was a big impetus behind Citizens United, in which Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, you know, obviously joined the majority there in overturning Austin for infringing on First Amendment rights. And then the second issue here is that you have actually a conflict of authority with Abood. So you have Abood, and in Abood, there's no question that the court did not apply exacting constitutional scrutiny to compulsory union fees. However, in almost every other compelled association case, that is exactly what the court requires. In political cases such as Elrod, in association cases like Dale versus Boy Scouts of America, Hurley, Roberts, you name it, it's exacting scrutiny. And then in Knox and Harris, the court again said exacting scrutiny applies to compulsory union fees. And so now you have the court in Harris and Knox making clear that, like all the other compelled associations, that standard applies, and yet you have Abood, which do not apply that standard. So compulsory union fees have never been subject to the proper level of scrutiny. So what's before the court here isn't just, do we just overturn this precedent just because it's wrong? Rather, you have to decide which precedents you're going to overturn, because you have this long line of authority that compelled association is subject to this high level of scrutiny, and then you have Abood, which didn't do it. And so I think that that's probably one of the strongest arguments for stare decisis, is that something has to go, and Abood is the weaker and more indefensible part of the equation there, as opposed to overruling, you know, this whole area of compelled association law and the scrutiny that applies to it. And those are the two main reasons against stare decisis. And the final one is oftentimes a reason for sticking with stare decisis is reliance interests. And here, there really aren't any. You know, all this is saying is employees cannot be compelled to pay fees to a union. If the court rules, that'll be obviously a great benefit to individual employees. By our estimate, there's 5 million employees who are subject to compulsory unionism in the public sector. On the other hand, there are no other reliance interests. The government can't claim this in any way sort of hurts them to not allow this constitutional violation to occur. So I think the reliance interests really aren't very strong for Abood.
Yeah, I think Bill's analysis is exactly right. People are correct to be concerned about the Chief Justice when it comes to stare decisis. And unfortunately, after the NFIB case, the Obamacare context, I think all of us are concerned that perhaps the Chief Justice may at times let the perceived political implications of a case affect his legal judgment. But I don't think this is a case where that's going to happen, in part because as Bill said, something has to go. It's really sort of almost a circuit split kind of situation where you have to reconcile something, and if one thing has to go, well, why not let it be Abood? I think, second of all, there's reason to be optimistic simply because the justices who voted to take this case, we don't really know who those were, at least four justices, seem to be excited about the possibility of overturning Abood. Obviously, the court has given a lot of suggestions in that case, in that direction, and this is not a case where it can be ducked. So I think the fact that the court took the case in the first place suggests that they have the stomach for overturning it. Certainly, there's going to be people who claim, this is going to be politicizing things. There's people like that in every case. But I think at the end of the day, the thing that most politicizes the court is the impression that justices are responding to political factors rather than legal factors. And so, as long as the court gives a clear legal analysis that is not saying, "Hey, well, we don't want to anger the unions, we don't want to do this," those would be the wrong things to look at. And I think there is ample legal explanation. The brief that we filed in the case talks about how much of an anomaly Abood is in the span of First Amendment law. That it was an anomaly when it was decided. It's still an anomaly. And so, really, this is correcting something. And the Chief Justice has, you know, as he did in Citizens United, it's not that he never is willing to overturn precedent. This, if you look at all of the rationales given for when stare decisis should be overturned, this is a very strong strong case for it. The original explanation of the case doesn't really apply any longer. It's not the one that the court even the respondents are fully defending. And in the constitutional context, that's where the court has to be free to be a corrective and make sure that we are still bound by the Constitution, not simply what some judges may have erroneously decided in the last few decades.
Well, we're out of questions. We're almost out of time, but I want to give each of you a chance to wrap up. Carrie, that might have been your summarizing statement there. But as you end, let me ask you to include, if you want to, any prediction, not on the outcome of the case, because I think you've both been pretty clear, but on the timing of the outcome. Is this going to be a case that's big enough or contentious enough or argued late enough in the term that we're not going to see an opinion until the final day or the final week of the term? But with that, final thoughts on the case, Bill Messenger.
I think that's probably right. It probably will go to May or June. I don't necessarily buy the theory that the size of the case puts it late. I think it's more of the existence of dissents. And Harris makes rather clear that there is going to be a rather vigorous dissent from probably four justices. But it could come faster, given that, you know, what's said in Harris, if the majority in Harris holds together, there may not be that much for either side to write, because basically both sides said what they thought about Abood in Harris. So if the battle lines remain the same, you know, the opinion may not take that long actually to come out. But my money is on May or June. And just as a final thought and just something to come back to is, you know, what this case is about. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we estimate there's about 5 million public sector employees who lack statutory right to work protections, which means most likely almost all those 5 million right now don't have a choice on whether or not they can be forced to support a union. And if Friedrichs comes out the right way, you know, those 5 million people for the first time will have a choice. How they exercise that choice is completely up to them. But I think that for them to have, you know, the choice that the Constitution guarantees them to choose who they want to associate with to petition and deal with the government, I think is a momentous thing. If Friedrichs comes out the right way, the biggest institute of compelled speech in the nation, you know, will stop, and what is most likely the biggest infringement on First Amendment rights currently going on in the nation. So the significance of this case, you know, is difficult to understate.
Carrie Severino, a final thought?
Yeah, that Bill's right. I think it's probably going to be simply because whichever way it goes, I think it's probably going to be a 5-4 case, and that suggests that it's likely that there'll be people going back and forth on dissents. It's possible they could just say see Harris and move on, but I suspect there'll be long writing in this. So given the fact that we're already into the second half of the term, it seems reasonable to think we're going to get it late in the term. I think I agree with him. This is an opportunity to really vindicate First Amendment rights. My only other final thought is I've heard some people sort of suggesting, well, is this a case of, you know, trying to vindicate a First Amendment issue, even though it hurts teachers? And I want to just point out that if there's the thing that will help, you know, the individual teachers the most, to give them the opportunity to not be forced to pay hundreds of dollars annually to support something they disagree with. So what I think the result that would vindicate the First Amendment also means that a lot of teachers in California will have more money in their pocket and at the end of the day, and are also going to have their First Amendment rights vindicated at the same time. So that strikes me as a win-win.
Well, my thanks to both of you, Bill Messenger and Carrie Severino. This has been very enlightening. A reminder to the audience that on the 11th next week, which is next Monday, we'll again host Bill Messenger as he sits in the oral argument and reports back to us on what transpires. That's on the 11th. But our next scheduled telephone conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. When we'll be talking about class action litigation. But until that call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.